Vice President tells an international conference on Islamic unity that Palestine is the priority of the Muslim world and should not be sidelined. UN experts are warning that overcompliance with U.S. sanctions threatens the Iranian people's basic rights to health. And people in the Iraqi capital Baghdad protest against election results and demand a manual recount of the October 10th parliamentary vote. It's good to have you with us. The Iranian president is urging Muslim nations to remain united and refrain from division.
We seek to ensure stability in Islamic countries, unlike the enemy which tries to create instability. We believe unity is the strategy that the Islamic community should adopt, but the enemy's strategy is to sow discord.
Faisi was making his keynote speech at the opening ceremony of the International Conference on Islamic Unity that's underway in Tehran. He says Palestine is the most pressing issue of the Muslim world and should not be sidelined. The president believes that the conference is an ideal opportunity to further promote Islamic awakening. He also urged the Muslim world to stand up to terrorist groups such as Daesh. Faisi says that corruption, poverty, and terrorism should be uprooted in the Islamic world. The president also encouraged closer scientific, cultural, and media cooperation among Muslim nations. The conference will last 6 days. A group of UN mandated experts have warned that overcompliance with U.S. sanctions could strip the Iranian people of their basic rights to health. Experts say that many banks and businesses, including pharmaceutical firms around the world, are complying with sanctions out of fear of penalties. It cited a Swedish company that halted the sale of bandages to its Iranian partner, and that resulted in the inability of patients, including children suffering from a rare skin disease, to access the bandage. They warned that such a decision by the firm violated its own human rights policies. Iran has time and again blamed sanctions for impeding its fight against chronic diseases, including the COVID pandemic, calling U.S. measures medical terrorism. Well, I had a conversation with political analyst John Bosnich, and he says that the U.S. sanctions on countries such as Iran and Venezuela are an act of war.
If we look at the behavior of the United States abroad, first of all, imposing sanctions on a foreign state is the interference in the internal affairs and a violation of the sovereignty of the foreign state. That's number one. Number two, if we look at the death toll caused by America, there are an estimated 40,000 people who have died in Venezuela due to U.S. sanctions, and the figures for the number of dead in Iraq, for example, ranges from 200,000 to 500,000, including no less than 50,000 children. These are the actual death tolls of American sanctions. America presents itself to the world as the global policeman. But actually, a policeman has to be empowered by a legal authority, which America is not. And therefore, instead of being the global policeman, America has become the global outlaw. And where it has imposed sanctions, it has actually engaged in acts of war. There is no other state on the planet that does anything near to what America does. And yet, America's media monopoly and regime of censorship keeps the American people unaware of what their masters, and I use the word masters because the American people do not run the American military-industrial complex. The American military-industrial complex buys the elections, places its stooges in power, and declares war wherever they want to make profit. What it is mass murder for profit. That's America today.
In other news, the Russian defense minister says his country is prepared to develop dynamic and versatile military collaboration with Iran. Sergei Shoigu was speaking in a meeting with Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Davari in Moscow. Shoigu added that Iran and Russia can expand their anti-terror fight in the region, and the Iranian general emphasized the importance of boosting defense and military cooperation between the two. Father, who is in Moscow on an official visit, has already held talks with other Russian military top brass. Over to Iraq, where people have hit the streets of the capital Baghdad to vent their anger at the outcome of the recently held parliamentary elections. Protesters, including supporters of the popular mobilization forces, waved national flags and chanted slogans calling for a new vote as they marched near Baghdad's green zone. They also called for a manual recount of the ballots and pledged to keep up their rallies until their demands are met. The Electoral Commission began recounting the votes after some political parties contested the outcome. The initial vote tally has put influencer cleric Murtada al-Sadr's bloc in the lead with more than 70 seats. The final results should be certified by the federal court. It's time now for the news review. Hezbollah Secretary General Saeed Hassan Nasrallah says that the Lebanese Forces Party was behind the killing of seven Shiite protesters in Beirut last Thursday. Naryam Salah has a report.
In a televised speech, Hezbollah Secretary General accused the Lebanese Forces Party and its leader directly of conspiring to initiate a civil war.
I need to tell you very clearly, the real project for the Lebanese Forces Party is instigating a civil war, because a civil war will lead to demographic changes that would put the Christians in one area to create a Christian canton controlled by the Lebanese Forces Party. There would be no place for anyone else in this area. This is our understanding of our experience with the Lebanese Forces Party and the path it is taking. One example is that they were ready to give the service of starting a civil war on behalf of the former Saudi ambassador Sabhan.
The leader of the resistance said the Lebanese Forces Party is trying to incite Lebanese Christians against Hezbollah, presenting it as an enemy. Said Nasrallah gave a detailed explanation of last Thursday's events, stressing that the security apparatus gave Hezbollah a confirmation that the first bullets fired by militiamen from the Lebanese forces against the unarmed protesters. This, he says, was all part of a plan to drag Hezbollah specifically to internal conflict orchestrated by foreign sides. Nasrallah said the U.S. is also trying to provoke an internal conflict in Lebanon the same way it did in many other nations. Yet Sayyid Nasrallah stressed the scheme will not succeed.
Hezbollah has 100,000 fighters. We did not prepare them to fight a civil war. We prepared them to defend Lebanon and our land and water and petrol and natural gas, which is being stolen under our watch. We prepared them to protect the Christian and Muslim towns in Baalbek al-Hermel. We were killed in Kaldeh and we were silent. We were killed on Thursday and we were patient. It does not mean we are weak or incapable. We are thinking straight and we have ethics. I tell the Lebanese Forces Party and its leader, don't miscalculate. Be disciplined. Learn from your wars and learn from our wars.
He warned that in the event of a military conflict, neither Israel nor the U.S. or Saudi Arabia will come to the help of any warring side.
Sayyid Nasrallah was clear in proving that the Lebanese forces had always tried to target the resistance. But he was also clear in the fact that Hezbollah will not be lured into internal fighting and that the resistance is a protector of civil peace and unity of Lebanon. And those who are pushing for civil war are at the service of a U.S. project in Lebanon and the region.
Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said in his speech tonight that the main guarantor for peace and stability is the Lebanese state and the Lebanese army. Therefore, Hezbollah will put its trust in the judiciary to bring those who martyred people on Thursday to justice. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Okay, now let's discuss this a little bit and shed some more light on it. So joining me will be a couple of guests. We'll have Elijah Magnier, a journalist and political analyst in Brussels. Also, Mohammed Abait, political analyst joining us out of Beirut. Good to see you, gentlemen. Elijah, we have Eli Hubaika, who is notorious for his role in the Sabra and Shatila massacres in 1982. He assumed the leadership of the Lebanese forces, or LF, after the 1982 assassination of Bashir Gemayel. So what does this tell everybody about the agenda of the Lebanese forces?
Thank you for having me. Actually, I was in Lebanon in 1982 and I witnessed the massacre of Sabra Shatila. It's good that you mention it and remind the world of that massacre and the responsibility of Israel and the Lebanese forces of the massacre of several thousands of Palestinians and Lebanese who were in those camps. What I think is the Lebanese forces leader, Samir Jaja, is trying to sell his capability to fire against Hezbollah and Shia demonstrators, really. It's not against Hezbollah. There were Shia civilian right to demonstrate and to contest against an issue that they thought it is their right to do so. And they were fired upon by snipers on the other side that belongs to the Lebanese forces. So the problem is that the Lebanese forces leaders has ambitions to become a president. This is not going to happen unless he tries to divide Lebanon, run by only the Christian that follow him, because he represents a very small part of the Christians, but not all the Christians in Lebanon, and not even half of them. So what he's trying to do is to force a kind of a reaction from Hezbollah to trigger a fear among the Christian and say, well, I am your defender, I am the one who can protect you, while in reality what he's doing is not he's scaring the hell out of the Christian, pushing them for another exodus, but what he's doing is just creating more havoc in the country to please the Americans and the Israelis, and to tell them, I may be able to succeed where you both have failed, which is unrealistic, really.
Now, Mohammed Abed, as you know, this Alif group also enjoys the backing of Saudi Arabia. Tell us about the dealings between this group and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the same country that arrested former Lebanese Prime Minister Hariri a couple of years ago. Is Riyadh considered by the Lebanese as a friend or foe?
First of all, thanks for having me.
Sure.
Second, the issue of Saudi Arabia is quite a little bit complicated, because sometimes it employs the new world. And then you have the issue of failing to have any supporters that are able to confront Hezbollah in Lebanon. Therefore, on Samir Jaja in this regard, after the failure of Saad Hariri in doing and performing this act. So it is quite a little bit illogical and one way or another, because we know that in Wahhabi Wahhabism, Christians are regarded as infidels, and they are not being regarded as people who sometimes who deserve to live in some context. But as we saw with ISIS and Wahhabi school graduates, but still. You have the issue to have a Christian as the representative of the Saudi policy in Lebanon. So still, it is a desperate step by the Saudis, following the failure of all the other puppets that the Saudis were able to use in Lebanon. So they resorted to this. By the way, in Lebanon, he is regarded, Samir Jaja is regarded as a thug, meaning you cannot believe that he's a politician because of his history. He was even sentenced to life imprisonment, but was out due to a pardon, a special pardon that was issued by the Lebanese parliament. So people do not regard him on the side of the Hezbollah and by the side of the what we call the March 8th, meaning the nationalist parties who are fighting against the Israeli and American imperialism in Lebanon and in the region. So he is not regarded as a politician in the first place. It was noteworthy that Sayyidina Abdullah in his speech, and this was noted even by the Israeli press, that Sayyidina Abdullah did not mention him by name. He did not say Samir Jaja. He said the president and the militia of the Lebanese forces. What I would like to focus on is the issue that Sayyid Nasrallah was used his very famous credibility and calmness in order first to explain what Sayyid Jaja is trying to do in the country. he is trying to do a sort of breaking Shias as an enemy.
Okay, let me turn to Brussels to Elijah. We have a technical problem with Mohammed Abbaid. Elijah, this group, the LF, also enjoys the backing of Israel. And you know, Jaja revived ties with Israel and rivaled the then Lebanese president, Jamail.
Yes, indeed. The history of the Lebanese forces goes back before the 1980s. It was in the 1970s. When the Kataib, used to be called the Kataib first, used to have a very good relationship with Israel. They were trained and armed by the Israelis. And then they were the first units that were used against the Lebanese in the civil war by the Israelis. And they were very useful to the Israeli when they occupied the capital, Beirut, and other parts of the country. And now, the ambition of Israel is to divert the attention of Hezbollah from the protecting the borders and the maritime right of the Lebanese population to an internal struggle or a kind of a civil war so that the Israelis can relax on the border and support one part of the Lebanese against another part of the secondly, even
Yes, go ahead. We just had a disconnection. Yes, make your point.
Even if in the worst case scenario, Hezbollah has made it very clear in the past that the units who are allocated to protect the borders with Israel will never move from there, and they will confront the Israelis. And Hezbollah doesn't need many troops for that.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Elijah Magny, a journalist and political analyst in Brussels, and Mohammed Abbaid, political analyst in Beirut, joined us with their comments and contribution. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Unity Week. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. We are in the Unity Week. This week begins on the 12th and ends on the 17th of the Islamic month of Rabiul Awwal. It was Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, who named this period as the Unity Week to unite Sunni and Shia Muslims. The Sunnis believe that the 12th of this month is the birthday of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, while Shias maintain that the Prophet was born on the 17th of the month of Rabiul Awwal. Please stay tuned for the first part of the special series on this occasion. Everyone needs a perfect and sure role model to reach sublimity and lofty moral virtues. According to the Quranic ayahs, the best role model is the messenger of mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. No doubt, following him will help us achieve true life. The Prophet of Islam was not negligent of God's remembrance even for a single moment. It is narrated that when he stood for prayer, his face would change, and there would be heard a sound from his chest and throat like that of scared people. The Prophet's wife said, "When we were speaking with the Messenger of God, as soon as the time of prayer arrived, he would change in a way as if he hadn't known us." God addresses the Prophet in ayahs 162 and 163 of Surah An'am of the Noble Quran, saying, "Say, indeed my prayer and my worship, my life and my death are for the sake of Allah, the Lord of all the worlds. He has no partner, and this I have been commanded, and I am the first of those who submit to Allah." God makes it clear that the element of the Prophet's success is that he was lenient, tolerant, and kind-hearted. He was not aggressive toward masses. In ayah 159 of Surah Al-Imran, we read, "It is by Allah's mercy that you are gentle to them, and had you been harsh and hard-hearted, surely they would have scattered from around you." Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "The hearts of the righteous were absorbed toward him. The looks were gazed at him. God buried old grudges by him, extinguished the burning flames of enmity, brought hearts close to each other, and made people brothers of one another." Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, used to behave people in a way that their personality was respected. It is narrated that when a person came to the Prophet, he would never look down upon him and would never allow others to humiliate him either. He would give him the best part of his house. If he had a guest who had no mat to sit,
he would spread his abaya for him to sit on. Famous historian Ibn Mas'ud writes, "One day a man was speaking with the Prophet, but he was shivering as the awe of the Prophet had impressed him. The Prophet noticed the matter, so he told the man, 'Take it easy, my brother. Feel at home. I am not a king.'" History bears witness that the Prophet of Islam lived the life of the lowest strata in the society. According to some narrations, he would avoid eating wheat bread as it was not accessible for most of the people at that time. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, said, "The Messenger of God never ate wheat bread and never ate barley bread fully." Dear listeners, barley bread and dates were the Prophet's usual food. He used to darn his garment and shoes. Although he had a simple way of living, he considered wealth as necessary for society and economy. He said, "Legitimately gained wealth is so good for a righteous man." Another aspect of the Prophet's simple way of living was that never allowed his gathering to have high and low positions. He would make his companions sit in a circle so that everyone was equal. His close companion, Abu Zar Ghifari, said, "The Prophet used to sit among his companions without any privilege, so that if a newcomer came, he would not recognize the Prophet unless he asked. Later on, he allowed us to build a platform for him from stone and mud so that he would sit on it and we would encircle him." Consulting others is one of the important orders that have been mentioned in the Quran. It is so important that God tells the Prophet in Ayah 159 of Surah Al Imran, "And consult them in the affairs, and once you are resolved, put your trust in Allah." For sure, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was the absolute intellect and was not in need of anyone. Yet, through consultation, he pursued two goals. First, he wanted to hold his companions in great esteem, and secondly, he taught others to shun egotism and dictatorship. At the end of this episode, we congratulate the Prophet's birthday and recite this ayah together. "Indeed, Allah and His angels bless the prophets. O you who have faith, invoke blessings on him and be fully submissive to him."
A simple question. Why is Britain increasingly out of stock? The United Kingdom has been hit by shortages in shops, at petrol stations, and in online deliveries. But what's causing this? Some blame staff shortfalls caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. But could it be that there's a deeper problem in the country, and one that cannot be easily resolved with a mass-scale vaccination program? After the United Kingdom's departure from the European Union, some claim that it has been an exodus of important workers from Britain that has contributed to this crisis. Amongst this exodus, it has been said foreign lorry drivers have returned to their homelands, while the local working population has been either unwilling or unable to fill this employment void. Shortages became visible and worrying to consumers as the public resorted to panic buying to fill their cupboards, thereby also emptying the shelves. The result is as curious as it is frightening for the public. The impact of these shortages has been to create a real sense that there is some kind of sanctions regime within Britain as the supply chain struggles to get products to shelves, and the products that are there are quickly bought up by a worried public. Online deliveries have also been heavily affected by the breakdown of the stock delivery system, as ministers consider making it easier to enter the UK if you have valid work credentials for haulage. Some point to this as going against the very reasons they voted for Brexit. What's causing these supply shortages? Brexit or something else? And how can a country as advanced as the United Kingdom end up with empty shelves and a shortage of basic goods? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. How does the public here in a typical part of London feel about the shortage of products on the shelves and online? Here's what they told us.
Quite sad, quite fearful.
Food shortages. I feel like, you know, we all need food, right? So, like, food shortages is going to be bad. I mean, I have food right now in the crib. I don't experience any food shortages, but
I think it's affecting people's lives. I think, for instance, if you go to the local shops or the corner shops, you know, they're charging extra money, apparently each item, extra 50, 60 pence or £1 difference. So I think it's quite costing to the public.
Not good.
Not good.
Especially if you've got kids.
I do understand some shelves are empty or getting empty. And I've been listening to what the government is doing as well. And I hope that will be sorted out.
A bit worrying. Not saying that I'm panicking, but I'm just wondering if we're going to cope for the next couple of months if the shortage start carry on like that. But, I mean, I'm cool. I'm still cool until something else happens. But, yeah, there's a little worried all the time. But, yeah.
I haven't seen any much. I'm still doing my shop normally. I still find the stuff I always buy. Haven't had any problems.
I can't do much about it because you go to Tesco sometime, I heard they haven't had a lot of chicken, Iceland. What can you do about it?
Well, I live in London and there's no shortage here. So I am up country naturally. Less resources, less population, you'd expect delivery levels would be less as well. So I really don't see a problem with that, to be honest with you. It doesn't affect us down here as such. So, but up north, it's understandable. I don't think there's a real shortage as such. I think it's a mixture of panic buying and stressing the system a bit. So I think people are being too enthusiastic about buying things that they don't really need. And just to say I have it for two weeks of supply. But on the face of it, there's not a real shortage, but we would like to justify it and use Brexit and all the political rhetoric to say that there's a shortage to put a little pressure on the government, which is fun. I like seeing them squeal a bit, but there is I still can buy bread, I still can buy milk, and I still can get meat. So I am covering the core nutrients, the core proteins. So I don't see a shortage around, to be honest with you.
To be honest, I can't do much about it.
a lot of my family is a bit worried, not that worried, but we know that it's going to, everything's going to come back, hopefully, fingers crossed. Food will be delivered and, yeah, everyone will be fine. I don't know why everyone's panicking, but yeah.
Well, it's kind, it's not, I don't like the fact that there's food shortages, and like, it's really depressing to see that some people won't, like, food is not going around as well as we would like it to, so, yeah.
I think it's quite shocking that there's a shortage, because I wouldn't have expected it in London, but I think we're kind of getting through it. It's just quite a difficult time for quite a lot of people.
So what is causing these supply problems? Brexit? COVID? Or something else? The public had a wide range of answers.
It could be a culmination of both. I mean, they both kind of happen simultaneously. So it's hard to say if it's this one or that one, because they're the most common denominators right now that we could look at in terms of why the shelves are unstocked.
I don't have a shortage. This is complicated now, yeah, with this coronavirus.
I would say combination, both, yeah, Brexit and COVID-19 as well.
Brexit definitely as, yeah, well, because they're shutting down the borders. Obviously, yeah, with the only borders we have open right now is the Irish borders, where we can import. So it's harder to export and import indefinitely.
Yeah. To be honest, I would not blame Brexit and all of it, but I think it's just a lack of years and years of not preparing people, not putting professionals on the ground. There's a lot of youth that they're not finished studying. So I think there's a combine of a lot of stuff. It's just a lack of worrying about social and integrate more people doing more labor instead of, you know, there's a lot of lawyers, ITs, but I think there's a lot of, you know, handcrafts and semi-skilled workers. There's not much.
I think it's a combination of all. Yeah, it's even though with COVID, a lot of people did panic buy, and which was not necessary. But I think with the Brexit as well, with everything, it's the uncertainty. I think that's what it causes panic. And then that's what happens, unfortunately.
Yeah, panicking a lot. Panicking is a big part of it, because especially when the COVID first happened, you saw the panic buying tissues, hand sanitizers getting run out. So I think, yeah, like, this country needs to learn how to control when a lot of the population is panicking.
Oh, well, it's just timing, just a cacophony of a mixture of different things and different factors coming all at once and hitting us at once. Brexit, COVID, the evergreen, I don't remember, has been stuck in the canal. All of that is culminating in the world supply chain being just in stasis, which has caused it fundamentally to seize up. It is because we're living in a globalized economy, and whenever someone sneezes in China, unfortunately, we will catch the flu, and that's just it. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just the fragility of the supply chain, the just-in-time theory, isn't working as such. And I think fundamentally we need to go back to basics, where we grow our own food and build our own cars, go back to the Leland days, go back to the Bedford days, when we were an independent country. Now we are so dependent on everybody else, it makes us look weak in the world and vulnerable to shortages, like we're saying, up north, but not down here.
A lot. I think it's the lack of delivery drivers, yeah, a lot, because there's a shortage of petrol as well. Shortage of food, I think it's because of COVID. Brexit is another cause as well, because we left Brexit. So, yeah, I think that's affected a lot of us as well, yeah.
I would think maybe right now, because of like the petrol crisis that have been going down, maybe it's the lorries or food deliveries that haven't been like coming in, because of everyone's been panicking about like petrol shortage maybe.
I think the shortage of lorry drivers isn't helping a lot, like with the petrol. There's a lot of queues, a lot of people worrying, trying to stock up on things so they don't go like without food for the winter.
So how can it be that an advanced country like the United Kingdom can start suffering shortages of basic goods? Here's what the people here in London told us.
To be honest, if I was to think of Britain, something like this, I wouldn't think it would happen here, because I'd think that everything was in order and like they would plan ahead, so something like this wouldn't happen, but I guess things happen.
Yeah, it's quite shocking that it's happening in London. You wouldn't expect it in like a big country connected to loads of other countries that we have shortages.
Wish I knew. It's panic, I think. Yeah, it's the uncertainty. I think that's what it is. And also, I think the fact that this this freedom of speech and we, you know, anyone can say whatever they want, and then it causes panic.
That's a good question, to be honest. That's something that I wonder myself all the time. What I've realized is, I don't know, but since this Brexit thing has happened, even though they promised us a whole different story, all this has been happening, panic buying, the country not controlling all these issues and stuff like that.
Well, I mean, wherever you go in this world, sometimes things over, sometimes things get down, you know. Sometimes things is very short, sometimes things all right. So, I mean, you have to just try to do better for one another, to help one another, to let the things flow. But sometimes things are here and the people are just trying to...
Well, I should ask that the government. I think government should put in place maybe something different in schools. Maybe going towards any technicians and choose different routes in education. I think the education goes so... of just going to the same place is media, is performing arts. There's a lot of things I don't see people not taking. All carpenters, you know, engineers, is all based in everything electrical, nothing on a you know, construction and things like this. So I think there's a lack of, even in agriculture, I think there's a lack of a lot of courses that could be introduced in education, and then just pushing the communities to go in a different place instead of just being concentrated in the same type of things. I think it's just a combine of things. I don't think you just Brexit all the way down, but I just see a lot of things, you know. We are multicultural in this country, so it's complicated.
As I said, I don't really have a strong opinion myself, but the people around me, they think there's just the workers that were there, they simply left to Europe, and that's why there's a shortage now. Yeah, that's...
I think choices of the politicians. I think they make choices and we pay.
I thought today's world, being in the UK, I would have assumed things would have been put in place properly to make sure such thing should not happen. So I'm really, yes.
That's very sad, you know, because it's very sad if everything stops, you know. But they should bring the army to bring all the goods into this country. What the army is doing? Nothing. They're sitting there and do nothing.
Let's consider the facts. Office for National Statistics data shows that the number of large goods vehicle drivers has fallen from 330,000 in 2016 to 236,000 drivers by 2021. Also, the average age of HGV drivers is 55 and rising, indicating fewer people are applying to become haulage drivers than are leaving the profession. By September 2021, it was estimated there were 54,000 unprocessed HGV licenses in the system, made worse by staff strike action, social distancing measures and home working. The Road Haulage Association now estimates that the UK is short of over 100,000 drivers. What should the government be doing to solve this problem of shortages and empty shelves? Here's the public's advice to ministers.
Yes, the government should have put some kind of on reserve, should have made sure, because Brexit was happening, this has been going on for a while, so the government should have put an implementation in things before they happen.
I'd say if they want to, you know, put more control into it, they could, like, add in more strict laws, more rules. Like, when the lockdown was happening, they added all these, like, new rules so quickly in order to keep it under control. So I think if they learn how to do stuff like that more, it could help the country a lot.
Well, the government have to send out, I mean, like, people out there to, I mean, spectaculate, like, go in the shop and take all the items and see what is going on, what is sent on top, what is selling for the government price. That's because, I mean, there are a lot of fake things in this country. Yeah, fake cigarette, fake this, fake that. People are sending for a lot of money. And that's what matches up the society. You understand what I'm saying?
well, it's a little bit too late. I think prevention is first thing. but now, pay rates, I suppose, that's the biggest interest for people to actually get the work done. So if pay rates would be increased, they would just go and grab the job and do it. Yeah, but prevention is the first thing, I suppose.
Yeah. It's quite a difficult question, but maybe if the government just helped more vulnerable people, so they don't have to worry, and making sure they don't like crazy buy loads of stuff, because it's unfair for the people who can't get as much things, can't afford travel.
I see the government ain't gonna listen, you know. But the government should really sort of scrap Brexit, open up the import entries, but that's not gonna happen. The government obviously wants this to happen to cause more hunger, to cause more stress, to cause less food on the street, to put more homeless in the street. Over it, what's going to happen in 2030 essentially is it going to cause a whole depopulation, mass extermination event.
Yeah.
It sounds crazy, but that's the goal, I guess.
I mean, me personally, I have no clue if they could do it better. But one thing for sure, I think, is they concentrate a lot of things in London. You know, central London is the main thing, and maybe we should go somewhere else. Maybe there's the private areas that have a lot of skilled people that, you know, should be, you know, spread, not be just London. This is my opinion.
You can start reinvesting in local industries, local farming. Start supporting and stop cutting the subsidies to the farmers. You need to replace the subsidies that the EU used to give us, and stop talking this nonsense about re-greening or rewilding the land while we have to buy from Spain, from France, from Thailand. We're buying fish from Thailand. I can't believe that. Tilapia, I don't know. We can't grow it here. We have salmon in Scotland. Why don't we subsidize Scotland so the price is competitive with tilapia so we can serve it in the schools? I don't get that one. But it is just the nature of the business, I guess. We don't want to be seen as subsidizing essential. We protect defense economy, which is our missiles, and you have to get the license. But we don't seem to protect our food for some strange reason. We don't buy British. We prefer international food. It tastes better, I'm not lying to you, but it makes us vulnerable, and that's it.
Think twice before you make a judgment. And don't spend your money on silly things. There's a lot of, especially here in Harlesden, a lot of knife crime. So I've heard a lot of train stations have been built, but at the same time, there's a lot of people here that are poor, a lot of people that don't have homes, a lot of homeless people around here, a lot of knife crime, a lot of drugs, a lot of drug dealing. Yeah, this is what Housing known for.
We asked the public how they feel about the prospect of ongoing out-of-stock products and the very real possibility that this could be the beginning of a long, cold winter of shortages for the entire country.
I don't want to think about it, to be honest. I'm just pushing that idea away. I had already a headache with this petrol thing, you know. So I'm just pushing away the idea. I'm hoping by the end of this year everything will be sorted, or at least the shortage will be sorted, and you know everybody could at least have a nice Christmas and everything. But I'm not. To be honest, I'm not very hopeful, but that's what I'm hoping for.
Very worried. Very. I've got 4 kids, so of course. So very worried that will make me. Yeah, it's food. It's not something that is unnecessary or extra. It's food. It's needed.
It will just bring us back to the same depression most of us went through last year in 2020. So I really do hope the government are spending all day trying to figure out a plan to counterattack this upcoming situation for the winter.
Yeah, I was probably trying to get some food supplies for myself. Yeah, frustrating, of course. Yeah, that would be frustrating. I think people might need a little bit of notice if that would happen, so they could survive the winter through. Yeah, there's other ways to get food, but yeah, if there's enough notice, then fair enough. If there's no notice, then very frustrating, of course. I would think of whether I should be actually staying there for a long time or not if these things are happening.
Yeah, actually, UK is a highly, highly rated country, apparently, and I think they should have put a bit. Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to rephrase my words, and I think it's a bit weird, so I think it's about time to fix it then.
Yeah.
Yes, of course, and I not a case of do they know they can do something about it, but I think they just want to put the fear into people for whatever crazy reason they choose to do it.
If it ever got to that, then we would transition to our emergency supplies, and then we'll start rationing food, which is the emergency procedure in every country. But, and I think we have enough rations to stock up to feed us for a long time. So even if it got to that, we would have a plan to get through that. And I'm not really worried about that, to be honest with you. Another point I'd like to touch on, the petrol shortage. There was no petrol shortage. I don't know why people were panic buying petrol. Do you see any more shortages? One week after, no shortage. There wasn't a shortage in the first place. I think it's just a mixture of misinformation on social media, as usual, the usual tool. They just say, oh, we have a shortage, let's go and get it. But in essence, I don't think we have a shortage. And I think the government isn't that stupid, to be honest with you. I think some of them are really smart people, some of them are clowns. And the really smart people tend to be planners. And if it ever got to that, we'd have to dip in our emergency situation supplies. And that's it.
Well, everyone will feel upset. Everyone will feel kind of hurt. But it's at the end of the day, it's the politicians. It's the politicians that make the choices. And like I said, we suffer, we pay. If they make a good choice, then it's good for us. If they don't, then obviously we suffer.
I would be unhappy because how are we going to get our food? And it's winter, nobody wants to step outside. Like, we would want to like stock up on food and like keep it at our houses instead of coming out and constantly in the cold as well. And like, it's not, and some people have children, so it's not a good time, basically.
Well, during coronavirus, it was quite similar. There was hardly anything. It was quite difficult for like my family because I have to do the shopping, so it's quite difficult for a lot of people having to worry about things that we shouldn't have to worry about.
Britain stands outside the European Union with supply problems, delivery issues, and self-generated panic buying by the public. So far, and despite assurances from government ministers that they are working to solve the issue, the public remains nervous and unsure that these shortages will be resolved in the months ahead.
This could be the legacy of decisions made by the country and by politicians who seem unprepared and unable to restock empty shelves, plus a haulage sector with 100,000 unfilled vacancies. And all the while, the UK, outside Europe, and in the midst of a supply chain crisis, faces these problems alone as it heads towards what could turn out to be a winter of discontent, out of solutions, and out of stock.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.